From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Gregory Hines gave up tap dancing after 25 years performing in a family act. When he returned to dance, he landed starring roles on Broadway and in such films as Cotton Club, White Nights, and the new film Tap. Gregory Hines on hoofing and acting on today's Fresh Air. Also today, we meet violinist Nadja Salinor Sonnenberg. She's outgrown her original accolades as a prodigy and is well on her way to establishing herself as one of classical music's premier soloists. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz takes a serious look at music often considered light and frivolous, the works of Pops composer Leroy Anderson. And film critic Stephen Schiff looks back at the life and career of actor and film director John Cassavetes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The new movie, Tap, is about an ex-convict who's also a former hoofer. When he gets out of jail, he's caught between two worlds, his dancer friends and his former partners in crime. Actor and tap dancer Gregory Hines stars with a supporting cast of veteran hoofers, including Harold Nicholas, Sandman Sims, Bunny Briggs, Jimmy Slide, and Sammy Davis Jr. Gregory Hines has been at the forefront of the recent tap revival. He's been dancing professionally since the age of 5, when he teamed up in an act with his brother Maurice. They performed together for the next 25 years. Hines starred on Broadway in Yubi, Coming Uptown, and Sophisticated Ladies. He broke into the movies with roles in Wolfen and the Mel Brooks comedy History of the World Part 1. In the film Cotton Club, he had a starring role as a hoofer. He co-starred with Mikhail Baryshnikov in White Nights, with Billy Crystal in Runnin' Scared, and with Willem Dafoe in Off Limits. Hines is a dancer who likes to improvise. In the new film Tap, he's given a credit for improvography.
I call it improvography because when I was working on the Cotton Club film, Francis Coppola was open to me improvising, but I realized that he needed 4 or 5 takes of a given dance before he was satisfied, and then he would choose whichever take he wanted to. And in the first take, I would improvise, and then I would discover steps in that first take, and I would include them in each succeeding tape because I wanted to make sure those steps got in the movie. And no matter which take he would select, they'd be in that take. And there was a tap dancer on the film named Ralph Brown, who he told me that he described his style of dancing as heelology because he felt he had very syncopated ideas with his heels. So I just came up with the word improvography in keeping with Ralph's description, because in effect that's really what I was doing. I was improvising and also adding in some choreographed steps.
Well, heelology sounds like it should be the study of people who are heels.
It's great. It's a great term, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it. A lot of older dancers in your new film, Bunny Briggs, Sandman Sims, Harold Nicholas. Do you think that there are big generational differences between what you grew up learning and what they grew up performing?
Not at all. I mean, there are differences. But I would say that the differences focus more on the kind of music that one likes to dance to and one feels comfortable dancing to. These great artists dance mostly to swing music and music of their era, and they relate to that kind of music. I relate to it, and I enjoy the flavor of that kind of music, but I prefer to dance to more contemporary rhythms. But really, in terms of the tap hitting the wood, we all really meet on the same level at that point. And for me, it was just such a great, great opportunity to work with, because these men are my heroes. They're my teachers in every sense of the word. And it was just a dream come true for me.
Gregory Hines is my guest, and he stars in the new movie, Tap. You started dancing when you were 5. What got you started?
My parents gave my brother and I, my brother Maurice and I, tap lessons. I think, like parents give their children piano or saxophone, so just something to round them out. And in those days, this is like the late 40s, I actually began at 2.5. You know, I can't imagine what I was doing at 2.5, probably just hopping up and down. But this is the family legend. I don't really remember not dancing. We took group classes at the local tap school. Somebody came by offering free lessons, and we got involved, and we liked it, and we seemed to show a little ability. So at that point, my parents found Henry Letang, who then really taught us how to dance.
And I should mention he's a choreographer for your new movie as well.
Yes, he is.
Whose idea was it for you to perform professionally at such a young age? I think, was five the age when you started actually performing?
Yes. I think that it was just a group decision. Henry and my parents, and I suppose some of the members of the family. In those days, tap dancing was still very highly respected and an area that a lot of people wanted to be in. And the Nicholas brothers were big stars at that time, and it was Henry's contention that we would be the second coming of the Nicholas brothers. And in fact, my brother and I patterned ourselves after them. I latched onto Harold, and my brother used his hands and danced like Fayard, and so we just started working. I mean, it was there was work, and you know, we were cute, and we could dance, and we enjoyed it.
Did you do acrobatics like the Nicholas Brothers?
A little bit, but in no way did we compare to the Nicholas Brothers in terms of the kind of acrobatic things that they were doing. We did some flips and some knee drops, we called them in those days. That's where one leg is straight and the other leg is slightly bent. Nicholas Brothers used to do complete splits, but we weren't. Our style wasn't into acrobatics. We were more tap, mostly tap and a lot of syncopated combinations.
When you were performing as a child, who kept the money?
What money?
You didn't make money when you were performing?
Well, we made money, but not much. I mean, in those days, you know, there really wasn't much money, and it was beginning to diminish as we were performing because tap dancing was beginning to go out. So there really wasn't a lot of money. I think some of those early jobs, maybe we made $25
mm-hmm.
for, you know, what was known as a club date. I remember New Year's Eve was a big night, and that performers would get paid double. So maybe New Year's Eve we'd get $50 for a club date, but there really wasn't a lot of money.
Was tap something that set you apart when you were a kid in school?
Not really, because we were professionals and from time to time had to go on the road to work. We went to professional children's schools, so I went to school with people like Patty Duke and Sal Mineo.
No kidding, really?
Sandra Dee. Yeah, and so you know we were just another. Another professional, you know, we were just in school with, you know, kids that could relate.
Now you did the Ed Sullivan Show when you were pretty young, right?
Yes.
How did he introduce you? What did he say?
You know, I don't remember. The only thing I remember about that is that in those days we used to wear a lot of grease on our hair.
Uh-huh.
Because the only way to get respect in those days was to have slicked down hair. And I remember after one of the shows, as we, you know, Ed, we did our number and we came over and Ed thanked us and we took a bow and he actually put his hand on my head. And I remember just for a moment, the shocked look on his face when he realized that he had at least an ounce of grease on his hand. And I thought, well, this is it. We'll never be on this show again.
And were you?
Actually, we did it one more time, but he didn't put his head on my head the second time.
You had been dancing with your brother for many years. When you were 18, your father joined the act, and the act was named Heinz, Heinz, and Dad. At the age of 18, would you have preferred to be on your own with just your brother? Were you glad that your father joined?
I was. And at that point, it was my father had been a musician for years, and he would be traveling in one direction. And my brother and I and my mother would be traveling in another direction professionally. And my father wanted the family to be together. And also he felt that he wanted to show a family working together in a cohesive way. This was during the time when the black family and the was coming under a lot of scrutiny. You know, this was way before the Huxtables, where people, you know, had images where they could feel good about the black family and good about themselves. And so Heinz, Heinz and Dad was really my father's dream in a way, and I liked it. I enjoyed it. Those were good years.
So he played and you danced?
Right, and then he would come down and do a number with my brother and I.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the 1960s, when you were performing as a family, there was really no vaudeville. There were a few Broadway tap dancing musicals. Where did you perform?
Mostly nightclubs and lounges. In the mid '60s, we worked Las Vegas lounges and all over the country, different lounges. And then we worked at the Playboy clubs. The Playboy clubs in those years was like vaudeville in that there was a club in each city around the country. And performers could work. There wasn't much money in it, but it was an opportunity to keep working every week and get better at one's craft. And then in the late 60s, we made a transition to main rooms, and we began opening for stars in main rooms around the country.
How did you like that atmosphere? Did you like the showbiz atmosphere?
I did. You know, I grew up in that kind of atmosphere, and I felt very comfortable there, and around musicians and other artists, and you know, getting a chance to work with people that I admired. I remember once we opened for Ella Fitzgerald, and it was, I mean, I was just so happy to be working with Ella Fitzgerald. We were opening for her, but Ella stipulated in her contract that we would get the same size billing on the marquee outside, and it was just such an honor to work with Ella Fitzgerald. One night we were working with her, and Cary Grant came running backstage and gave Ella Fitzgerald a big hug. And I mean, you know, it was a terrific experience just to be around a lot of these people, and I learned a lot.
Let me ask you, in the late '60s, when a more radical black consciousness was forming, was tap considered politically retro by people who you knew?
Well,
I'm just wondering, because there was a period when tap had a kind of reputation for being a timing kind of performance.
Well, there was a group of people that felt that way, but by that time, tap dancing had really gone out,
and
it really wasn't possible to make a living at tap dancing anymore. And in fact, Heinz, Heinz, and Dad, we had stopped tap dancing, and we were doing jazz dances and popular dances of the time in the act. We just, I mean, people just weren't doing it anymore, so we just discontinued it. But there was a group of black people who felt that it wasn't a good image to be seen tap dancing.
Why not? I mean, where did that come from?
Well, I think that at that time, black people were really beginning to feel good about themselves, and in an effort to feel as good as possible, we're looking at all the aspects of black art and black entertainment and trying to get rid of anything that they felt was stereotypical. And so tap dancing was one of those things, and it just, you know, it got caught up in that wave. And, you know, I understood it. Even though I had been a tap dancer, I understood it. You know, I remember growing up watching Amos and Andy, and I always loved Amos and Andy. But at that time, you know, they felt that there were a lot of people who felt that Amos and Andy was not a good thing. And so there was a big campaign to get it taken off the air, and I understood that also.
Did it get to you at all personally?
Not really, because at that point, I mean, we had just discontinued tap dancing.
And I see, right.
Uh-huh. I just figured, you know, that was it for tap dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because of the way a group of black people felt, but also because in the entertainment business, it wasn't a viable way to make a living anymore.
So that's why you gave it up in around 71?
Right.
Well, I want to talk with you about what happened during that interim when you gave up tap dancing for a few years. But first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is dancer and actor Gregory Hines, who stars in the new movie Tap. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Dancer and actor Gregory Hines is my guest. He starred in the Broadway musicals UB, Coming Uptown, and Sophisticated Ladies, and in the films Wolfen, The Cotton Club, White Nights, Runnin' Scared, and Off Limits. His new film is called Tap, and it features not only him, but many other tap dancers. And Gregory, welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
We were just talking about how you gave up tap in 71, about how you thought that there was really no place to perform it anymore. You moved to the West Coast for a few years. Did you stop dancing altogether, or did you just give it up professionally?
Well, what happened was that at that point, the act, Hines, Hines and Dad, I was beginning to question a lot of things at that point in my life. I was married to my first wife, and we had a daughter, and we had a nice apartment, and we had a car and a dog, and I was miserable. I was very unhappy, and it wasn't so much the marriage and my wife's fault. It was me, and I just had a lot of problems and a lot of questions. I think some of it was due to the fact that I had really been working from the time I was 5 years old, and had been in a situation where everybody was making decisions on what was going to be, and I always had somebody buffing between me and what was really happening: my parents, my manager, my agent, my publicist, my businessman. So, at that point, I wanted to stop. The act broke up, and I moved to Venice, California. And I was a hippie for 5 years. And, you know, it was that time of turn on, tune in, drop out, free love. And I thought to myself, I want to do that.
When you were doing all of that, did you tell people that you used to be in showbiz, or did you keep that to yourself?
Well, I was still in it in a way. I played guitar and sang in a jazz rock band called Severance. And it was just one of the most growthful times in my life. I discovered the joys of being a father. My first wife and I developed dynamic ways to co-parent our daughter, Daria, and she would live with me for 3 months in Venice, and then she'd go and live with her mother for 3 months on the East Coast, and that was just a terrific time. I met the woman that I'm married to now, and I learned how to take care of myself. For the first time in my life, I was on my own, and I learned how to really take care of myself and my daughter, and enjoyed playing with the band, and just it was terrific.
What got you back into dancing again?
Well, in 1977, at that point, my daughter was in the first grade, and it really wasn't the right thing to do to pick her up every 3 months and take her out of her schedule. So she was living in New York with her mother, and I thought I was going to be able to get by with 6 weeks during the summer vacation and alternate Christmases, but it just didn't feel right. I felt like I was losing touch with her. So I decided to move back to New York and see what I could get into. And the very day that I moved back, my brother had his agent submit me for a musical that was auditioning. And, you know, when I talk about this, it sounds like a corny B-movie. But, I mean, this really happened. And I went to the audition. The musical was called The Last Minstrel Show, which, in fact, it turned out to be the very last minstrel show because it closed in Philly. But I got it. I went and auditioned, and I got a part in it. And the next day, when I found out I had gotten it, my brother's agent told me that I got it on the strength of the fact that the director choreographer knew that I could tap dance. Now, at that point, I hadn't had on tap dance shoes in about 8 years. And so I ran out and bought a pair just to see if I could still do it. And I got back into it. And once I started dancing again, I remembered how much I loved it and that I missed doing it.
You had to buy a pair of tap shoes? You didn't even have any left?
No. I had cut it loose. And naturally, when I dropped out, I threw out, you know, everything.
Well, you did several musicals, UB, Coming Uptown, Sophisticated Ladies. You started making films as well. I think your first film was Mel Brooks' History of the World, Part 1.
Well, that was the first film that came out. Actually, I had I had made Wolfen before that, but Wolfen was at that time mired in a lot of post-production problems. But it's true, History of the World Part 1 came out first. And you know, once I got into The Last Minstrel Show and it closed, I got very aggressive at that point because all of a sudden I was getting a paycheck. And I liked it. And I, you know, on a good week in Venice, in the Venice days, I made maybe $40 a week. And here I was, I think I was clearing like $275. And I was able to buy my daughter a dress and go out for dinner and send for Pamela, who at that time, you know, we were still going out, but she would come and visit. And it was great. So I got very aggressive and, you know, I developed the ability to be aggressive right up to the point of being obnoxious.
What's one of the most aggressive things you did to get a role in a movie?
I barged into Robert Evans's home, and I was trying to get into the Cotton Club, and I had had a lot of conversations with him already, and he was, you know, he knew that I was hounding him. It was like a reign of terror that I had instituted against him. And I barged into his home, and I had my hair slicked back, and I had on like a 40s suit. And he was in his living room reading, and I just came in and I shoved everything off of his coffee table and got up on his coffee table and danced. And after I danced, I said, you know, and that's why I should be in this movie. And then I left.
How did you get into his house?
Well, I had been there a couple of times. So, you know, I showed up. And the guy, his butler, I guess, he came to the door and he said, is Mr. Evans expecting you? And I said, expecting me? I said, you know, we have a meeting. He didn't tell you? So he let me in.
Very clever. You've been in several buddy movies. In White Nights, you're paired with Baryshnikov, and Off Limits with Willem Dafoe, and Running Scared with Billy Crystal. In all three of those movies, it was like black actor, white actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if in movies like that, there are things that the white actors get to do that the black actors don't get to do.
Well, typically that happens. But I've been fortunate in that White Nights was developed for Mike and I. For Baryshnikov and I. And so there were things that I got to do and get in the script that might not have been there ordinarily. And also, I've gone up for parts that were written white.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually the scripts that I see that are written black, the characters don't have as much dimension as I need. And there's not a wide range of emotion for the characters. White scripts that are interchangeable, where it could be played by any man, a lot of times have more dimension to them. So I go up for those. I read them, and I try to get the part. And that's what happened in Running Scared. And it just so happened in Running Scared that the part I was right for was the guy who had the love scene. And the part that Billy was right for was the guy who had the ex-wife. And I think that had it been written for a white guy and a black guy, I don't think the love scene would have been in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just very rare that we get to see blacks in romantic and sensual and sexual situations on the screen.
What are other roles that you've gotten that were written white?
Wolfen was...
Where you played a coroner.
Yeah. Wolfen was, which was my first film, was written for a white actor. Deal of the Century that I did with Chevy Chase, that was written for a white actor.
You say it's rare for black actors to get love scenes. Have you ever argued that a love scene should be written and included in a part?
Well, not argued, but I've certainly lobbied very heavily for it. In the Cotton Club, Lonette McKee, who she played Lila Rose, who was my girlfriend in that film, she and I both would corner Francis Coppola every chance we got and urge him to write in a love scene, and he did that. And in the film Tap, which also was another project that was developed over a 2-year period, I did that with Nick Castle, who directed it and wrote the screenplay. And he was in agreement. I mean, we wanted to have a love scene and some romance and real sensuality between my character and Suzanne Douglas's character. It hasn't been, you know, a fight, but it's certainly been something that has been important to me.
How did you learn to act? I mean, you danced all your life, you'd been performing all your life, but you hadn't been acting.
No, you know, it was just in the doing of it, and one of the most fortunate things that happened to me in my career was that my first film, Wolfen, the star of the film was Albert Finney, And I can't say enough about Albert and the way he helped me in that film, because the director, Michael Wadley, it was his first feature, and he wasn't the type of director then who would come up to actors before takes and talk to them about motivation and the character and what might be happening. And many times at the beginning of a scene, I just didn't have the slightest idea what to do. I was just concentrating on my words so that I would know what to say. And every time Albert would come over to me and he would just make suggestions to me, you know, like 5 minutes before we were ready to shoot. And it just, I mean, it made my performance, because I really didn't know what to do. And Albert really helped me. And every time I see him, I just feel so warm towards him, because he really turned me on to acting and ideas and how to do it.
Have you ever used your dance experience to help you in a stunt?
Many times. I mean, I like to do stunts, and I've done a lot of them in my films, and I have a stunt double who I've worked with in every film, really, that I've had stunts, a man named Greg Elam, and he's worked with me a lot, and anytime I have to do something that appears risky, he'll go up and test it or somehow test the rigging, and it looks to me like he's actually trying to fall. You know, he just really tests it good, and so I feel pretty secure when I do it. And he also, you know, he's able to, if I get up to do a stunt and I get frightened, he can let me down easy. He does, because, you know, stunts is a very, like, macho thing. And some people do stunts when they don't even want to do them, but it's hard for them to get up there and say, well, I don't think I want to do it. And Greg has, you know, been really good about that. So I've been able to do stunts and sometimes do some that I was a little bit frightened of, but Greg got me through them. And sometimes I was going to do some and he just wouldn't let me, or would say, you know, I think I'd rather you not do it.
Well, I have one other dance question to ask you. I've noticed that frequently when you're dancing, you're looking down, mm-hmm. and I was wondering if you're looking at your feet.
Not actually at my feet. Sometimes I look at my feet, but not actually. Just I'm not sure what I'm looking at, and a lot of times when I'm dancing, I'm somewhat unaware of what's happening around me, and I'm not really focused on any one thing. It's just I guess it's just an idiosyncrasy that I have. I don't know. It's a strange feeling. Sometimes when I see a film of myself dancing, I wonder, you know, what's going on, or what was going on, or where I was looking.
Is it a stylistic thing, the difference between looking down and looking straight ahead?
I think so. You know, when I was a young boy coming up, there was a big emphasis on, you know, looking at the audience and performing and smiling, and I did it for a while, and then I just didn't feel comfortable. I felt like it just felt like I was working too hard to perform, and it just seemed to me that I wasn't able to get into what I was doing. I was performing more for the people as opposed to trying to really enjoy my dancing and try to say something. And so as I grew older, I just got out of that and just developed into the style that I have now.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
My guest has been dancer and actor Gregory Hines, and he stars in the new movie Tap. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Violinist Nadia Salerno Sonnenberg seemed to go overnight from prodigy to classical music star. On today's Fresh Air, she updates her story and tells us what her life is like now that she's becoming a veteran. Also, remember the Pops War Horse, the syncopated clock? How about the typewriter? Those pieces and a lot of others you'd probably recognize were written by composer Leroy Anderson. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a newly available recording of Anderson's music. And film critic Stephen Schiff remembers the late John Cassavetes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The White House delivered to the Capitol tonight a substantial portion of the FBI report of the investigation of Senator John Tower to be Secretary of Defense. Linda Wertheimer reports from the Capitol.
Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, the Armed Services Committee chairman, and the senior Republican on the committee, Senator John Warner of Virginia, met with White House counsel for more than 2 hours tonight to examine written reports on the FBI investigation into allegations that former Texas Senator John Tower has personal problems. Both senators declined to comment on what they learned from the reports. The meeting with White House counsel was followed by a meeting with Senator John Tower himself in Senator Nunn's office. Senators Warner and Nunn said Tower requested the meeting, and they regarded it as routine. After waiting for 24 hours to see the FBI report on Tower, Senator Nunn said the investigation into allegations about Senator Tower's personal life is still incomplete, and that an additional investigation into financial problems will probably delay a final report for a week to 10 days. I'm Linda Wertheimer at the Capitol.
The Senate today unanimously approved Clayton Yeider as Secretary of Agriculture. Yeider, who served as U.S. Trade Representative in the Reagan administration, said he will use his new post to continue the government's quest for farm trade reform. U.S. District Judge Gerhard Gesell today rejected a Justice Department request for a new security safeguards in the Iran-Contra trial of Oliver North. The government had asked the judge to prevent North from making unannounced disclosures of classified information. Gesell chastised the administration for the last-minute appeal for greater security. The government request had threatened to delay North's trial on 12 felony counts, but Gesell said today he will move forward with jury selection and opening arguments. Portuguese rescue workers fear there are no survivors in today's crash of a U.S. charter jet in the Azores Islands of the Atlantic Ocean. The Boeing 707 carried a 7-member American crew and 137 Italian passengers bound for a Caribbean holiday. At least 50 bodies had been recovered by nightfall. Al Goodman reports from Madrid.
The plane was said to be flying low today, just before it smashed into the tallest mountain on Santa Maria Island, about 900 miles west of Portugal. The Boeing 707 was operated by the American charter company Independent Air Corporation of Smyrna, Tennessee. This morning, the jet left the Bergamo Airport near Milan. The Italian tourists on board were headed for a vacation in the Dominican Republic of the Caribbean Sea. The U.S. jet reportedly had been chartered for the excursion by a Dominican company. The stop on Santa Maria Island was meant to be just for refueling, but the 1,800-foot-tall mountain on the island was said to be fog cover just before the crash, and the American pilot had requested an emergency landing, according to the Portuguese news agency Lusa. The crash occurred 4 miles from the airport. For National Public Radio, I'm Al Goodman in Madrid.
A strike by coal miners in Poland is causing concern as the Solidarity Trade Union and Poland's communist rulers hold new talks today. The strike, about 90 miles outside Warsaw, has spread despite Lech Wałęsa's efforts to stop it. A government spokesman says the strike is aimed against the principles of reform. Local union leaders say the issue is pay. Hundreds of anti-apartheid detainees in South Africa have joined a hunger strike for freedom. More than 100 detainees at a Port Elizabeth prison issued a letter today saying they would starve themselves to death if necessary. Yesterday, 118 Johannesburg prisoners published an open letter to the government saying they too are refusing food. The strikers say that since the government doesn't have to bring them to trial or give reasons for detention, fasting is the only way to press for release. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 4 points to close at 2343.21. Advances and declines were about even on volume of 189 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You may recognize that music from The Early Show or The Late Late Show. It's by composer Leroy Anderson. In a career that spanned more than 40 years, Anderson became best known for dozens of snappy novelty tunes. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of a new set of CDs of Anderson conducting his own music. It's called the Leroy Anderson Collection.
Listening to these delightful CDs of Leroy Anderson recordings made between 1952 and 1962, I've been trying to figure out what name to give the form of music he wrote. Mendelssohn wrote songs without words. Isn't that Anderson's musical genre? If Schubert wrote musical moments for the piano, could we call Anderson's three-minute pieces symphonic miniatures? Is he not taken seriously because he was so popular, or because his pieces were so short, or because his primary outlet was the pops? Or was he just never ambitious enough? Anderson was a music major at Harvard in the late 20s. In 1936, he started writing for Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops. I have to confess, and this is a dangerous admission to make if you live in Boston, that I'm not a fan of the Pops. I hate the way good popular music is homogenized into phony, quasi-symphonic arrangements for which they were never intended. And Anderson wrote his share of these. But his original music for Pops was different, part of an authentic tradition of Americana, the band concert, one of the original ancestors of Pops. In the early 30s, Anderson had led the Harvard band, and his use of brass instruments descends directly from Herbert L. Clarke and John Philip Sousa, as in his familiar Bugler's Holiday. Anderson used all sorts of popular forms, from waltzes to jazz. In 1951, Blue Tango became the first instrumental to reach number one on Your Hit Parade. He himself played piano and organ. He was a church organist, double bass, trombone, tuba, and accordion. He loved colorful instruments like sleigh bells and penny whistle, and even added a few to the repertory, like sandpaper, an alarm clock, and a typewriter. Thank you. Anderson's most ambitious undertaking was probably his Broadway show about silent movies called Goldilocks, with a book by Gene and Walter Kerr. It wasn't a hit, but it acquired a devoted posthumous following. Here's the opening of The Pyramid Dance, music for the making of a silent movie epic. This collection has its share of facile and sentimental numbers. Anderson's tunes never pierce the heart the way those of the great American songwriters can. But the ability to entertain, the talent to amuse, as Noel Coward once wrote about his own talent, shouldn't be too easily dismissed. His best numbers have a bright wit and charm. In their small way, they're memorable. Leroy Anderson reminds me of the ending of one of my favorite poems by William Carlos Williams, The Pink Locust. I am not, I know, in the galaxy of poets, a rose, but who among the rest will deny me my place?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the Leroy Anderson collection on the MCA label. This is Fresh Air. Every time I hear Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg play, I am more convinced that she is an extraordinary violinist with a genuine artistic personality in the grand manner. That's what classical music critic Tim Page said in a 1986 New York Times concert review. Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg's career took off after she won the Naumburg International Violin Competition in 1981. Since then, she's been a much-in-demand soloist in Europe and America. She's widened her popularity through appearances on The Johnny Carson Show. Salerno Sonnenberg was born in Rome. When she was 8 years old, on the advice of her music teacher, she moved to America with her family to study music. She recorded two albums in the last year. This is an excerpt from her recording of Brahms Sonata No. 2. Cecilia Lacott is at the piano. Do you feel like you're starting a new part of your career in the sense that you're no longer a prodigy and you're even not the newcomer anymore? You're becoming a more established figure in the world of music.
I do, in the sense that I don't feel so much while I'm playing, even if it's a debut, that I have to prove anything. I'm very comfortable now with my interpretations in the way that I play. And so in that way, I don't feel new. I do my thing, and I'm much more comfortable with that.
When you say do your thing, do you mean that you interpret as freely as you want to?
Yeah, I mean, I always did. I mean, mm-hmm. I play the way I play. I have really no choice in the matter, but now I feel more confident with what I do musically, what I do on stage, with the whole career. I just feel more comfortable with it.
How did you start playing violin?
I was 5 years old. My family, we were all in Italy, and it's a very Italian musical family, typical, would have people over for dinner, eat a very good dinner. Afterwards, entertain. And that meant my mother playing the piano, my brother singing, my grandfather playing the trumpet, and my grandmother playing the kazoo. I mean, the whole family was very, very musical. And I sat under the piano. I was very young, and I didn't have an instrument. So a friend of my mother's suggested to her that she get me an instrument because I might get a complex just because I had nothing to play. So she went out and bought this violin and bow and the case and rosin. The whole kit was like $40, and that's how it started.
Did you like it right away?
I liked playing it. I thought it was a really neat toy, but I certainly was not into practicing.
Your mother was a music teacher. Did she ever teach you?
Yeah, well, she didn't teach me. She made me practice. And in that I mean that she made sure that I did my allotted time when I was young. And I would, when I was young, I would play with her little pieces and sonatas and things like that.
I think sometimes it's hard when it's someone in your family who's teaching you.
Yeah, it wasn't always very pleasant.
What was unpleasant about it?
Well, because she was my mother as well as my like coach when I was younger, and if I didn't play the way she wanted, there's no playing, no going outside, no dinner, no TV. So that wasn't too cool.
What were the rewards for playing well?
Nothing. I get to have dinner. nothing special. Poor family.
Did you ever, when you got a little older, go through a period of rebelliousness where you wanted to stop playing or to stop playing classical music?
Yeah, I went through a period for 9 months where I didn't play, actually, at all. I was 19 years old, and I it was a period of uncertainty. I just didn't know if I wanted to do this for the rest of my life, and more importantly, whether I could actually succeed at it. It wasn't even a matter of knowing whether I wanted to play the violin for the rest of my life. I knew that, but it was not knowing whether I could actually succeed the way I wanted to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the premise was, if I don't try and I fail, well, then I have an excuse. But if I do give it my all and I fail, then I'm not good enough. And am I ready to take that risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, what made you decide you did want to take that risk?
I missed playing the violin. I wanted to play again, and I thought, I have to try, and if I fail, I fail. Within the 9 months, I gathered the courage to admit that if I fail, then I'm not good enough. Then I'll have to do something else. But I cannot quit without giving it my best effort.
So do you think that was really a necessary stage to go through so that you could really gather up your own courage and self-motivation, which you'd really need in the years ahead?
Yes, it was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
When you're really starting off with a career, you have to build an image in a way. I mean, you get your press kit and your photographs and everything. Was that something you gave a lot of thought, or was that stuff you really left in the hands of others?
I have learned a lot in the last, since Naumburg, in the last 8 years. I have learned a lot about the business of classical music. At that time, no, I didn't know anything about it.
You've gotten a lot of attention for the way you dress and performance, sometimes wearing jumpsuits, wearing very brightly colored things, when the more kind of traditional costume is a black dress or something like that.
Not necessarily for women, no, but dresses are more traditional, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did you feel about the reaction you got to the clothes that you wore?
I was very surprised. I remember specifically going shopping for something that I could wear on stage that was comfortable. And we saw a purple jumpsuit, and I tried it on. It was extremely comfortable. It looked good, and the color was very, very good for the stage. So we bought it. I bought it. And truly unbelievable response, I was shocked. It still surprises me that people find it so unusual what I wear on stage.
What does it say to you that it's found so unusual?
It says that classical music needs, I think, to not be so steeped in traditions of long, long ago. I have an enormous amount of respect for the stage and for performance, and I would never think of walking on stage in anything that isn't elegant and appropriate. But if you didn't see what I wore, and if you read what they say I wear, you wouldn't think so. I mean, you'd think I walked out in a jeans or something. And it's not the case. And I am, again, I reiterate, my main concern on stage is comfort, because I don't want to think about anything but the music. I don't want to have to feel my clothes or that the shoes are too tight or anything like that to distract me. That's why I wear what I wear.
You're on the road a lot now, guest performing with orchestras around the world. Do you practice in your hotel room?
Yeah, I practice in my hotel room. I don't like practicing in my hotel room. And because of the heavy schedule, which any artist has to deal with, I have therefore decided to take a short sabbatical in which I will be able to practice leisurely and with concentration and without getting calls from neighbors saying, please stop, and I'm trying to take a nap and things like that. So I am taking a short sabbatical in order for me to practice the way that I would like to practice.
Is that a difficult decision to make?
No, not really. It wasn't difficult at all for me to make. It becomes a little difficult to arrange when you are booked 2 years in advance. So that sort of thing is a little difficult, but it's certainly not a difficult decision for me. I want to have some good practice time, quality practice time.
What are some of the things you want to do over the next 5 months on your sabbatical besides practicing at home?
Well, I will be taking lessons, which is something I'd like. I'm really, really looking forward to. In no way could possibly say that I know everything there is to know about playing the violin. Nobody does. So I'm so looking forward to becoming a student again for a few months. And I'll do some fishing, and I will be able to relax from this schedule. And I'm also planning on doing some writing and learning German.
Well, great. I hope you enjoyed very much. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg records on Angel Records. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Alex, what's coming up?
Hi, Terry. We'll have coverage of the continuing controversy over Secretary of Defense designate John Tower. He was called to the White House this morning for a conference with the president's national security advisor. There are reports of new allegations about Mr. Tower's personal conduct, and there are serious questions as to whether or not the Senate Armed Services Committee can vote yes on his confirmation and then send his nomination to the full Senate. Also, a new dispute in the Oliver North trial over secret government documents that both sides seek to use in that trial. So those stories will be coming up later this afternoon.
Thanks, Alex. That's on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Cassavetes directed films like Faces, Husbands, Love Streams, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, and A Woman Under the Influence, intense emotional films that relied on the workings of an ensemble of actors, including many members of his family. His death last week brings to an end an era in this cinematic family business. Film critic Stephen Schiff remembers John Cassavetes.
You couldn't call him a visionary, or even an original. At best, he was a kind of inspired cook. A stewmaker who would throw his favorite actors and flavors into a pot and then add heat and spice until they either blended or didn't blend, until the mixture came alive or fell flat or exploded. John Cassavetes had been an actor before he turned to directing, and he remained an actor until his death. He understood actors, and he knew that if you let them run the movie, it would be a little like letting the crazy people run the asylum. The result would be ragged and noisy and even dangerous, but there might also be something wonderful about it. Something you wouldn't get at any other way. Most of the movies Cassavetes directed pretend to be slices of some kind of life. The camera is rude and shaky. Scenes look unscripted, and they have no beginning or end. And the performers are Cassavetes' pals and his family and his wife, Jenna Rollins. And yet, as naturalistic as the look and textures of the films are, nothing in them seems real. They look overwrought, hyped up, spiced to burn. And maybe that's because the movies aren't real life as it might be lived by real and ordinary people. We're watching real life according to actors, so that everything is grand and theatrical and intense and much too much. Just listen to the Sturm und Drang Cassavetes and Roland stir up in Love Streams.
You all right?
I'm washing my face.
Oh, well, love is dead. Love is a fantasy little girls have.
Okay, I'm tired. I just want to be by myself.
Oh, how old is she, 13? I mean, is she 13 years old? She's hit puberty, for God's sakes. That's what happened to her. Her insides have turned all inside
about
out.
Children.
And she doesn't know what she's saying.
I don't intend to discuss my daughter
all right,
with
Jack,
you,
you have a husband, right? What's he in? Is he an architecture, architect, right? He's just like me. He's a guy. He's a man. He loves women. He goes out with women. He has a good time.
You're talking about a guy I've been with 15 years who's put the food on the table and clothes on her back. I mean, we've had experiences of the heart you couldn't even imagine.
Love Streams, as it happens, was Cassavetes' best movie. Chaotic, painful, hard to understand. The story of a crazy brother and crazy sister, played by Cassavetes and Rollins, and their kids and their pets and their house. It was a movie that made no sense in a way. But by the end of it, you felt you had experienced not a mere story, but a demonstration of certain natural laws. The movie depicted love as an unstoppable, unknowable force field, and people as its unwitting agents, dancing like so many iron filings at its behest. For me, the power of that experience, and a few others, Ben Gazzara's moony sweetness in The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, for instance, and the spunk of Jenna Rollins in Gloria, these made up for all the mawkishness and overindulgence Cassavetes' movies heaped alongside. As an actor in films like The Dirty Dozen, Rosemary's Baby, and Tempest, Cassavetes was always a charming demon, someone who dared you to accept the bad along with the good. His work as a director was like that, too. The saddest thing is that when he left us last week at the age of 59, he was just beginning to achieve what his jagged talent had always promised. He died just this side of greatness.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with Frank Chin, a Chinese-American writer who thinks that many of his contemporaries have done a disservice to Chinese history and traditions. Also, critic Ken Tucker reviews Lyle Lovett and his Large Band, the third album from Lovett, who Ken says has established himself as country music's most satisfying eccentric. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses the evolution of the book as a means of packaging information for public consumption. He says that despite new technology, the future of the book is secure. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Sharon Saunders. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.